It's not a genre you see much anymore, but Westerns were once a staple of American movies, cowboys versus Indians and all that. Look closely at an older Western picture, and you see people playing Native Americans who clearly are not Native. We'll spend this hour talking about a person who pulled off such a masquerade in person. Edgar LaPlante was his real name, but he had many others, including Chief White Elk. Our guest this hour wrote a book about LaPlante and his hijinks of a century ago. Paul Willits is the author of King Khan, The Bizarre Adventures of the Jazz Age's Greatest Imposter. Paul Willits is based in England, where he's written works for The Guardian, The Times Literary Supplement, and others. He's also the author of four previous books written primarily for UK audiences, so this book is his US debut and an auspicious one. Paul Willits, thanks for joining us.
Hi there, Jeffrey.
Is it fair to say your earlier books deal with spies and skanks and people who find themselves in uncomfortable situations?
I think that would be fair enough. I mean, I've drawn towards those sort of miscreants. And I think someone pointed out the other day that each of my books had featured, well, actually, I mean, it probably isn't strictly accurate. There was one diversion into the territory of people that don't continually move around. I mean, I live quite a static life myself, so maybe that's what draws me to these itinerant types like Edgar LaPlante, alias Chief White Elk.
Boy, he really did move from place to place, and just usually barely ahead, and sometimes not even that much ahead of the law and certainly the reporters. Were you looking for someone else when you came across the name of Edgar LaPlante?
Well, yeah, I was just browsing through. It was a very odd genesis, really, that this book had. These things come about through happy accidents, and I was browsing through the computer version of the UK National Archives, and I was looking through crime files. It is really wrong to say I was looking through the files. I was looking through these file headings on the computer.
They tell you what the archives are, but you can't actually see them.
Yeah, they tell you the basics, and there's a heading, and you can tell what you need. What you need to know is there, really, whether it's worth investigating. And I was looking at crime files, really partly because tending to write, although I've written a couple of biographies, I tend to be much more interested in what publishers would call, it's a rather clunky term, narrative nonfiction. So the things that are solidly factual yet resemble in texture and surface and structure novels. And so I'm after these stories which have a novelistic and intrinsically dramatic quality. And quite often, crime stories provide that. I mean, there are a lot of true crime books about, some brilliant ones around, and you can see why true crime is a popular genre for writers, not just readers, because it's so well documented. That's the thing. If you're a nonfiction writer with an inclination towards the novelistic and historic, old crime files will provide you with a hell of a lot of characterization and textual detail and subjects that are inherently dramatic. So I was looking through these crime files, and I'd keyed in, used the keyword American or America within this, just out of curiosity. I was looking at stories outside Europe, and I narrowed this enormous number of files in the UK archives. It was something like 10,000. It was narrowed down to about 250. And I was scrolling through these things, and they were mostly pretty mundane and dull. They looked it from the headings. And then out popped this one file. I just thought, this is love at first sight. It was, let's try and remember the heading. It just had a gloriously funny heading. It said Raymond Orage Tuana, alias Edgar LaPlante, alias Chief White Elk, American international swindler. And from there on, I just thought, this is probably my man. And I then requested the file from the National Archives. I don't live in London, I'm talking to you from London. So I trot down to London and have a look at this file, which is mainly composed of Scotland Yard observations and records about Edgar LaPlante, because he was in London for a while, or in England for a while. And there are also some Swiss contributions from the Swiss police in the file. And it was just extraordinary. And I often find with nonfiction stories that they can seem strange to start with, and then they just have a habit of getting stranger and stranger.
Follows
that trajectory. Sorry, Jeffrey.
I was just about to say pretty much the same thing, but it seems like you get the sense early on in the book that Edgar LaPlante really couldn't stop himself, that the lies just kept cascading out.
Yeah, it's a fascinating scenario. Well, he's a fascinating character, but people have often, I think it's a misnomer to describe him as a con man. And he's more interesting than that, really, because for him it was never about the money. With contracts, I mean, there's a whole genre, isn't there, of fiction and non-fiction, both in movies and books about con men, and they're wonderful, but in the end it's all about greed, both the greed of the people who are conned and the con men and con women. But with Edgar Lapland, his motivation was about attention. And he was forever up, a bit like a drug. I mean, he ends up getting into drugs of various sorts and alcohol very heavily. But his behavior was a bit like, analogous to a drug addict maybe taking heroin, and the dosage keeps going up and up and up to achieve the same or more of an effect on him. So that he'd get away with one scam, and he was obviously thrilled and profited financially from it, but he wouldn't just repeat it. He'd do a grander scam. So there's a built-in trajectory of escalation within this story, which is obviously perfect for someone like me.
It's like
perfect for his victims.
Right, true. And it's just amazing that he not only pretended to be people who didn't exist, but he also impersonated other people. And we'll get into that when we come back from the break. Our guest is Paul Willits. His book is King Con, The Bizarre Adventures of the Jazz Age's Greatest Imposter. Maybe more than a con man, maybe less. You'll have to be the judge of that. We'll come back and talk more with Paul Willits. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the British author Paul Willits, who has written a number of books, generally for UK audiences, about miscreants, as he puts it. And he found a great one right in the middle of the United States about a century ago. A guy named Paul LaPlante, rather Edgar LaPlante, who decided that he was going to be going as Chief White Elk. And a lot of people bought it. And a lot of people gave him some money for his appearances, and he pretended to be other people as well. Paul gets into all this in his book, King Con, The Bizarre Adventures of the Jazz Age's Greatest Imposter. Questions and comments, welcome on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Paul, the first part of the book is quite thrilling as the news of the fake Tom Longboat, this is a real person and an athlete, well-known one, catches up with Edgar. Any indication that Edgar liked the danger of staying ahead of recovery, discovery and catcher?
I'm sure he must have done. But, I mean, there's a lot of external evidence about his personality, but there's also, he was examined at a much later stage by a psychiatrist, and so you can get a pretty reliable grasp on his motivation, and someone else was asking me about him, and to summarize him, it occurred to me, and without risk of exaggeration, you could describe him as a cross between Jay Gatsby, obviously the great Gatsby, and Tom Ripley out of The Talented Mr. Ripley. There's that sort of love of the extravagance of Gatsby and the masquerading as other people, and there are all sorts of levels of thrill that he could extract out of the situation, and he was, or any given situation, and he was a guy who had come out of medicine shows and theatre, and he was quite a significant vaudeville performer who could fill 2,000 seat auditoria, and as a friend who read an early draft of the book and was always very helpful with the books I've written, he was saying to me, "Well, why isn't it enough that Edgar LaPlante could easily have become a very major vaudeville star? There's endless examples of people saying this man had the most amazing baritone voice I've ever heard, yet just the applause in the theatre wasn't enough. He obviously had to be someone different." And I mean, there's a sort of tragic side to that in a way that I suspect, without sounding like some sort of down market psychologist, I would think that he's probably escaping. He came from this quite pretty, I was going to say bleak, but just an ordinary working class Rhode Island background. And he was clearly escaping from that, that he felt that wasn't enough, that he deserved, as he would see it, a much richer, kind of more exotic and interesting background.
So this is where the story really does get interesting, is it not Native American, not from the West. His parents weren't even from the United States. They were Quebecois, French-Canadian. He did grow up, at least for a few years, in Central Falls, Rhode Island, which is, you know, Pawtucket Central Falls. It's an industrial area, or was. Moved to Springfield, Massachusetts. Did he have any kind of a really career track developing there?
Well, very early on, yeah, it developed. The earliest criminal evidence, or evidence of criminal activity by him, which is very telling about motivation, it dates from when he was, I think it was 14, yeah, it was 14, and he was going around Central Falls pretending to have been sent by local shopkeepers to collect change for them. So he'd waltz into a shop and say, I'm from Mr. Bloggs down the street, and he needs some spare change. And he'd pocket a bag of change, ostensibly for this shopkeeper, and go off with it. And he did this a fair few times until he was caught. But he didn't, like most kids I would imagine the majority of kids who pulled that sort of stunt would spend the money on themselves. He didn't. He just handed it, very tellingly, handed it to his dad, saying, this is the proceeds from a spare time job of mine. So it was, as I say, it was never about the cash. It was clearly about the thrill.
Huh. So, and then he did spend some time in reform school, as you point out in the book. And this is not a reform school, I think, in the sense that most of us came to know it. It sounds like he got some training and some skills there.
Did. And I was very struck, actually, because I assumed, as soon as I found this evidence of him being sent to a reform school as a result of this sort of minor series of cons he was pulling as a 14-year-old, I assumed that when I saw the name reform school, I pictured this kind of Dickensian grim institution. And everything I've read a lot about, pardon my pronunciation if I got it wrong, I think it was called Soconusset School for Boys, Reform School for Boys, and it seemed a pretty admirable institution. They really tried to reform the kids and offer them all sorts of opportunities, and they exhibited at the St. Louis Fair and craft work that the boys had made, and they offered them all sorts of lessons, music lessons, and I suspect that it was there that his musical talent started to come out, but I haven't any evidence. But the boys certainly performed a lot of concerts, and they went on concert tours, that sort of thing. And I did come across lovely kind of injunctions from the school authorities that were in the school magazine about the sort of behavior that their boys were expected to follow. And there were these maxims, and there was one that was that made myself and my editor laugh about, don't pretend to be someone you're not, a maxim he clearly didn't take to heart.
Indeed he didn't. We're talking about Edgar LaPlante, who toured the country as Chief White Elk and also spent some time as Tom Longboat and Chief Tawana and several other names along the way as well, not just in this country, but also in Europe, which is the subject of Paul Willett's book, King Khan, The Bizarre Adventures of the Jazz Age's Greatest Imposter. So he split from New England, ended up at Coney Island. What did he end up doing there?
Well, he ran away from his parents, or moved away from his parents, and he was in his early 20s, I think, at that stage. Yeah, it would be early 20s. And he was tired of it. He'd been working as a laborer, and his dad had moved. By that stage, the dad was on his own. Well, he'd remarried, actually, after the death of Edgar's mom. And he moved the family to Springfield, where the dad actually was working for the brewery, Highland Brewery, run by Dr. Seuss's dad, in a rather odd connection. Yeah, so Edgar got fed up with this manual labouring he was doing, and he went off to Coney Island and got a job as a so-called ballyhoo man outside an animal show called Bostock's that was on the Dreamland amusement park. And there he was paid to dress up as a Native American, and the ballyhoo men And as with a lot of nonfiction writing, you learn a lot, and I certainly knew, I assumed a Ballyhoo man was a sort of guy who was doing a sales spiel, but actually they were just paid to stand on a platform outside a particular show, as Edgar LaPlante was, and he would just do anything to attract the attention of the crowd. And as soon as he'd whipped up a crowd, or brought in this crowd of passers-by, the guy who's doing the sales spiel would then take over and persuade people to buy tickets for the show. And Edgar was talent-spotted by a medicine show manager, and he was recruited to this East Coast touring medicine show. And he was part of a so-called Indian medicine show, which was specialized, there were a number of them at that time, specializing in or using people dressed up as Native Americans who were selling what passed up. There was a widespread belief at that time that the Native Americans possessed these remedies that were withheld from the white man, and the medicine shows exploited this idea, and Edgar LaPlante was part of this scam. And he then branched out on his own, selling from street corner pitches. And obviously, with that sort of activity, there was a very thin, like a blurred division, if any division, between salesmanship and criminality. And from there, he got into vaudeville. And then when he starts stealing people's identity and pretending to be Chief White Elk, in some senses, that combines his criminal past with his past, with his theatrical past, because he's performing off stage, really. And he did serve some prison time in New York for impersonating a government official. So he's got this long history of mimicry.
All right, so he has this skill then that he uses from place to place and in ever-increasing ways. That is the subject of Paul Willett's book, King Khan, The Bizarre Adventures of the Jazz Age's Greatest Imposter, and that is Edgar LaPlante or Chief White Elk or Chief Tawana or any one of a number of other names. 800-838-3760 if you have questions or would like to join the conversation by phone. You can send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I want to talk about not just the performer but also the fertile ground he found in the audience. And at this point, it's great in the book that you tell us about the groups like the Red Men and the Daughters of Pocahontas. What were they about?
Well, I included those because I was trying to understand why, what the particular attraction of Native of pretending to be a Native American would be for a white man of that period. And there were a number of these so-called. I was listening to an interview with Kevin Young, the poetry editor of The New Yorker, who'd written a book called Bunk about imposters and cons, and he introduced me to a word via this interview that I hadn't come across before, referring to these people as pretendians. rather lovely kind of term. I'd heard a very funny Native American phrase for them, calling them the members of the tribe of wannabe, but pretendians is even better. And I was trying to understand what drew these white people to masquerade as Native Americans. And there were these groups like the Improved Order of Red Men and the Daughters of Pocahontas, which was the women's auxiliary, in effect, of the Improved Order of Red Men. The Improved Order of Red Men was a sort of quasi-Masonic society that had a huge membership. I think at one point it was estimated to be about 1 million across America, and Teddy Roosevelt was a member of this group. And when they, for their ceremonies and public parades, which were numerous, they would dress up in their interpretation of Native American attire. And they actually, I was able to find out that the Central Falls were one of the Central Falls wigwams. I think that was how they divided these groups. They actually march past the front door of where young Edgar and his family were living. So white people dressing up as Native Americans from an early age was clearly something that was part of his experience. And he'd have also been introduced to Native Americans and white people's idea of Native American culture through popular novels like Last of the Mohicans, dime novels, and also through what was new to me until I started researching the book, a genre of silent movies which had Native Americans as the heroes and heroines, but frequently those, as you mentioned earlier in the show, those parts were played by white people. So I think to a great extent, that exposure of white people to other white people pretending to be Native Americans actually softened up lots of white people for these predatory imposters, for people just like Edgar LaPlante, who could roll up into a city like Salt Lake City and within a few days con the governor of Utah and the mayor of the city into believing that he was the chief of the Cherokee, and within a matter of, you know, through this guy's, Edgar LaPlante's, handsome looks, his talent, his acting talent, singing talent, and his charisma and powers of persuasion, he was able to bewitch a genuine American, Native American woman, and within a matter of days have her accept a marriage proposal from him. And the governor of Utah and the mayor of Salt Lake City laid on a public ceremony on the steps of the state capitol in Salt Lake in front of 5,000 people.
And this is of significance.
Astonishing.
It really is, and it's significant even further to our region, because Bertha Thompson was half Klamath, and we broadcast to the Klamath region. So how did he? First of all, it's hard to pull the different threads of the story apart. But he was in Salt Lake City after he'd already been nabbed for doing some stuff in Pueblo, for example, and had spent a couple of days in jail. He always seemed to find a way to talk his way out of jail. So not that he, you know, decides to hide from the public for a while, but instead he goes to Salt Lake City and meets Bertha Thompson, and that was like a real whirlwind romance, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's a fascinating sort of, as you say, there are many threads to this story, and she's a, I became, both myself and my editor became fascinated by Bertha Thompson, because she's a, I've did quite a lot with my books. I always try and do various levels of research about the story, the people, and also the culture in which the story is set. And one of the aspects of the cultural research that came up was that keyed in with Bertha Thompson, who, as you say, was a member of the Klamath. She would be what would then have been described as a new woman. She was really a proto-feminist. She'd left her family, and she trained to be a nurse in San Francisco, and she was living an independent and interesting life. And she had talked about her people's culture, and she'd fronted a parade through San Francisco by an organization called the Daughters, Native Daughters of America, I think was the term. And she was a great friend of this another fascinating character called Emma Bell Freeman, who was friendly with a lot of young Native Americans in California. And Emma Bell Freeman had specialized, she was a photographer who ran an art shop and photography business.
And her pictures are gorgeous.
Yeah, they're absolutely lovely, and they're quite sort of idealized, dreamy portraits. That was her style of Native Americans. And she regularly had Bertha, who was a glamorous, yes, very attractive woman. She would marry a model for Emma Bell Freeman. And at one point, Edgar LaPlante was introduced to Emma Bell Freeman, who took some fantastic portraits of the pair of them. There's a lovely one I can visualize now of the pair of them posing in this redwood forest with Chief White Elk seen in profile and his wife crouching in the foliage and almost blending in. And Bertha wrote a lot of letters to. Bertha became a very close friend with this white, he's a Wyoming-born rancher named Lucullus V. McWhirter, who had set up home in that part of the country, in California. And he was a great campaigner for Native American rights and was given a Native American name as a sort of thank you by the tribe he was helping. And he became very close to Bertha, and she wrote some immensely touching letters to him about the plight of Native Americans at that point, and she was very, very candid about her marriage to Edgar LaPlante. She didn't realize he was a fake. I mean, that's another extraordinary aspect to this story, that he could fool even someone so close to him emotionally and physically.
Now, she left him while she was pregnant. What was the undoing of that relationship?
Well, he was, they, they went on, they ended up going on a tour. They were promoting a film, and it had an all Native American cast, really obscure but quite beautiful silent movie called Before the White Man Came. And they were hired by the movie company to tour across Canada promoting this movie and giving little talks about Native American culture both before and after the movie. And she documents this, or parts of this tour, and the emotional trajectory of their marriage during this tour in these letters. And by the time they start the tour, Edgar Laplante has become increasingly dependent on cocaine and morphine, and he's a heavy drinker. And the roots of this addiction were in a slightly earlier period when he was touring around California with another dodgy character, an army recruiter named Frank Spaulding, aka Frank the Singing Sailor Spaulding, another character you couldn't invent.
Let's pick it up on the other side of a break. We have to take one now. King Khan, The Bizarre Adventures of the Jazz Age's Greatest Imposter. Paul Willits is the author and our guest. We'll come back and talk more with him and hear about Frank on the other side of the break. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're hearing about one of the great grifters of the America of a century ago, a man whose real name was Edgar Laplante, but who decided that he'd gain a lot more fame and fortune if he went around as Chief White Elk, also Chief Tawana, and sometimes as Tom Longboat. And there were a few other names in there as well. That's just what he did in the United States, and then he moved his game to Europe after a while. All of this is covered in a book by Paul Willits called King Khan, The Bizarre Adventures of the Jazz Age's Greatest Imposter. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, add some details, or ask some questions at 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So we were just starting to talk about Edgar Laplante working around California with an accomplice named Frank. He did occasionally have sidekicks or short con guys to help him.
Yes, he did. And in this instance, he and this guy called Frank Spaulding. Frank Spaulding was a real Navy recruiter, and they were traveling around California doing their routine, and it became increasingly self-serving, I think it'd be safe to say. And Frank Spaulding, his rank was a strange-sounding rank. He was a pharmacist's mate in the Navy, and I suspect that he's the person, because he had access, I know, through that rank to drugs such as heroin and cocaine, which hadn't been made illegal at that stage. And that part of America was certainly awash even at that stage, that period, we're talking about 1918, with those drugs. Anyway, however it happened, Edgar Laplante became a heavy user of them, and it placed an increasing burden on his marriage as he and Bertha Thompson, his wife, started touring Canada with this movie show of the silent movie Before the White Man Came. And eventually they adopted a Native American child, and Bertha just felt that the drug was really taking away the future of her and their adoptive child, their adoptive daughter, and robbing him of the future. She felt, I mean, it introduces, in lots of ways, this story is quite comic, but it does introduce a really tragic side to it, and that it really, her unfortunate meeting with Edgar Laplante really wrecked her life. And from Canada, we use Canada as a jumping off point for Europe, as if it wasn't bizarre enough, and there's a temptation with these sort of narrative nonfiction books to use these subtitles about the greatest whatever. But I think his antics in Europe justify the subtitle of The Jazz Age's Greatest Imposter, because he decides to travel to England to seek an audience with the British King, King George V. And obviously Canada at that time was a British dominion, so King George was the monarch of that particular region. And Edgar Laplante traveled to London, was met by hordes of paparazzi, as we call them now, when he lands in Liverpool, and he is granted an audience with the king to talk on behalf of his people about improving educational conditions for them.
Wow. All right. That is a first class kind of thing. The thing that I keep looking for somebody who was on to him. You know, you have to remember this is a time when communications were slower, but that we still did have. I mean, we had telephone and telegraph by this time. This is a century ago. So every time I would think, all right, go journalists, go, because people did figure him out, and then send telegrams to the city where he was to warn people about that. And it still seemed like he always managed to escape scrutiny. And then, in fact, there's the story of one newspaper that actually ran side-by-side pictures of Tom Longboat, the actual athlete, and Edgar LaPlante pretending to be Tom Longboat. And
yes, I mean, it's deliciously bizarre. Poor Tom Longboat was... that's one of the things that interests me about or gives me a great kick in nonfiction is we have these preconceptions about the past, and often we think phenomena like identity theft are something distinctively new, and then you discover identity theft has been practiced at least 101 years ago. So we're talking about 1917. Poor Tom Longboat, who was a big-time celebrity then, was a Canadian native long-distance runner who'd competed at the Olympics and was very, very well-known. And he was fighting in the First World War at this stage when Edgar LaPlante was strolling around America profiting from his name and achievements. And poor old Tom Longboat, who was stuck in a shell hole somewhere in France, was when he eventually found there was this imposter trading off his fame, was furious. But even quite a long time after, as I remember, after Edgar LaPlante was rumbled and it became widely known that there was someone pretending to be Tom Longboat, newspapers were still illustrating stories about Tom Longboat's mistaken stories about his death during the war. They were illustrating those stories with photos of Edgar LaPlante.
Jeez. And so this raises up another question, because at the time that we pick up the story at the beginning of your book, it's 1917, 1918. America is at war, and fervently so. We get 100 years ago in the local paper every day from the Medford paper, and it's clear that the public was whipped into a frenzy pro-war. And so how did this guy, who's clearly able-bodied, manage to pull off not being in uniform?
Well, he claimed to have various disabilities, and then at a later stage he claimed to have been a veteran of in the guise of Tom Longboat, really towards the end of that facet of his various scams, the Longboat one. He volunteers. He needs to get out of America. He's being trailed by the early version of the FBI, the Bureau of Investigation, though their filing system is too fragmented to keep track of him because he's continually moving. And he volunteers for the civilian part of the American Army Transport Service. So he's a civilian crewman, rather, on one of their ships, the SS Antilles, shipping troops to France. And he travels to France there and back, just the ones. And he endures some close-run things with German U-boats. But then on the next voyage of the Antilles, he's no longer on that ship, but the Antilles is sunk on that second voyage. And he then starts posing as one of the relatively few survivors from that shipwreck. And he invents these fascinating stories. You can see the way, as a storyteller, things morph and they become within his imagination as he tells and retells, a bit like some raconteur, really, on a much bigger scale. You can see how the stories get bigger, and he's got a flair for the dramatic, a sort of novelist's eye for detail. And he claims to have been on the mast of the Antilles as she was going down and was flung from it, and he claims various wounds at different points. And at one point after he's got back to America, he's drifting round with a sidekick, and he's claiming that he's lost so many ribs they've installed this metal plate. And this was fantastically comic. And he was tapping on his chest, and which was producing this metallic sound, and he probably got tin plates stuffed up his shirt. And people were falling for this routine.
Wow, no con to pass up. No, nothing too big, no too small.
No.
So you mentioned the audience. He actually got to meet George V and an urge for better treatment of his people, which weren't his people.
Yes. Well, he never actually. He secured an audience, but he was rumbled at the last moment,
which ties
in with one of your. Sorry to mislead you. He conned them, the royal hierarchy, and they Buckingham Palace had granted him the audience. But at the last moment, this was one of the delights of this story, because there's a lot of dialogue that was recorded by journalists with him in various contexts, and a lot of it's very funny, and you see how quick-witted he was. Before coming on to the royal element of the story, he'd claim, as part of this kind of inflation he was prone to. Things, for instance, he'd say, well, I speak 7 languages, and then it would become 12. And in one place, I think on a Canadian tour, he said, I speak 21 languages. And someone corners him and says, so you claim to speak 21 languages. Do you speak Scotch? And he quickly replies, no, but I can drink it, which is very nice, which has a kind of Jimmy Durante kind of air about it. And when he's cornered, there's some more of this kind of dialogue. When he's cornered by a journalist from a still prominent British national newspaper called the Daily Mail, and this journalist rumbles him, but doesn't quite rumble him fully. He rumbles him as a fake Canadian, not just as a fake, Canadian native person. He just thinks he's a native person who's pretending to be Canadian. And he says to Chief White Owl, he says, well, how come you've come to speak to the king, and you're about to speak to the king on behalf of the Cherokee people in Canada, when you're not Canadian? And the speed of his response. Chief White Owl replies to this journalist. He says, well, my people were here before the white man, and we know no boundaries. You just think, well, fair enough. Yeah, there's not much response to that. And off he goes. And he then goes off on a tour of variety theatre, the equivalent of American vaudeville, round England. And he's very handsome and charming and sexually omnivorous, that he's a bisexual. And there at Scotland Yard primarily became interested in him because of his, what were then, illegal doings in theatre dressing rooms with various male pickups.
Oh, that's why Scotland Yard got it. None of the others, just the fact that he liked
boys. Yes, that was it. It is totally potty. I mean, another aspect of that English tour that gave me great amusement was that he goes off on this tour of these theatres talking about Native American culture and singing as well, and he's on these, as I say, what you would call vaudeville bills of all sorts of performers, unicyclists and ventriloquists and God knows what else. And he ends up at one point in Manchester in the northwest of England. And he's living there. He rents a room with this family. They're a couple of Cockneys from the east end of London. And he romances the couple's daughter, Ethel, who's a single mother. At that point, it would be a subject for disgrace, being a single parent within the society of that era. And she thinks she's met this fabulously wealthy Cherokee chief. And he's obviously charming, and her son obviously likes him. And they decide to get married. And the marriage certificate, I just couldn't believe it. Again, you just couldn't invent it. At that era, the British marriage certificates would have, obviously, the names, and they'd have the names of the bride and groom's fathers and their occupations. And under hers, it said Billy Holmes, salesman. And under his, it says Father Chief Wolf's Robe. And then the bit that really got me, occupation, he'd just written ruler. It's marvelous, isn't it?
It really is. Not shy at all. It really gets down to, I think, that Edgar LaPlante could really read a crowd. He really, in fact, you mentioned in the book that he liked to get closer to the footlights because he could see the audience better and get an idea of what their reactions were. So it raises the question whether the performer's skill is so close to the con man's.
Yeah, I think that's a really legitimate question. I think you're right that in lots of ways, that those the skills that you would build up to become a good performer are the skills for that kind of contract. Oh, but obviously you need to be driven by something else because the performers are driven by the acclaim. Well, obviously they need to earn a living and they might want to become rich, but what I would have thought gets them into the business in the first place is the sheer enjoyment of it and the thrill of applause. And as with anything, I suppose, that whether you're writing or presenting radio programs, if people say, oh, you're good at that, we really enjoyed this, you spend more time doing it and you become better at it with any luck, and it's self-perpetuating, right?
It is. So we have been kind of giggling all through this. The fact is that the public sort of approves or at least likes to hear the stories of these charming rascals, like Catch Me If You Can, for example.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually funny you should mention Catch Me If You Can, but I was reading a book about confidence tricks and about why we fall for them in general. It quoted this great line from the guy whose ghosted autobiography Catch Me If You Can is based on, Frank Abagnale Jr., who works now as a consultant or a general advisor for the FBI about this sort of thing. And he was asked someone said to a journalist, I think it was, said to him, surely you wouldn't be able to get away with this if you were trying these sort of tricks now. And he said, no, it would be much easier, much, much easier.
Wow.
I can only assume that's to do with the way you can spread false information on the internet and use it to validate your story.
You really can. The book is called King Khan, The Bizarre Adventures of the Jazz Age's Greatest Imposter. Paul Willits wrote it and joined us today. Paul, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure.